So not to be outdone in the outrage department here that went back and forth between Congress and the CIA, but a man named Jake Garn, a Republican from Utah and a very staunch defender of the agency, he leapt to Bill Casey's defense and declared on the floor of the House in one of my favorite quotes from an American legislature, quote, "You're all assholes." The whole Congress is full of assholes. All 535 members are assholes. End quote.
So let me just start by saying, Shane, you ignorant slut. I want to suggest that there are a few things that are really overrated. And they are roughly everything we talked about today. That is to say, national security, the Fourth Amendment, and law. And there's one huge thing that is grossly underrated, and that's culture.
I'm Cody Poplin, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, February 14th, 2015. That was Shane Harris and Benjamin Wittes that you just heard, familiar names to frequent Lawfare readers, no doubt. Ben is the editor-in-chief of Lawfare and a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Shane is a senior correspondent at the Daily Beast and most recently the author of At War, The Rise of the Military Internet Complex. A few weeks ago, Shane and Ben spoke at Washington and Lee School of Law's symposium on cyber surveillance in the post-Snowden age. It's a lighthearted but thorough overview of the prevailing debates around NSA surveillance, including the role of congressional oversight, our evolving perception of privacy, and how the law can respond to rapid technological change. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode number 110, Shane Harris and Benjamin Wittes with Serious Jokes on Surveillance.
It's my pleasure not only to moderate, but to introduce our two concluding guests, if we want to refer to them that way, our two concluding thought provokers.
Oh, yeah. Bring it.
Is that what we're calling it now?
Ben Wittes and Shane Harris, as the expression goes, know each other. Ben is a senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution, and he's co-founder and editor-in-chief of Lawfare, a national security blog. He's a member of the Hoover Institution's Task Force on National Security and Law. He's co-director of Harvard Law School Brookings Project on Law and Security. He's currently working on a book on data and technology proliferation and their implications for security. He's co-editor of Constitution 3.0, Freedom and Technological Change. His article, Data Abuse, Digital Privacy in the Mosaic, is an article, one that generates tremendous discussion in Margaret's course particularly, and I had the pleasure of reading that article this past week and found it enormously thought-provoking, and I might, I think Ben's going to focus on something else in his remarks, but I might take a moderator's privilege and prod him a little bit about that paper, if we have time. He's also the author of multiple other books, including Detention and Denial, The Case for Candor After Guantanamo, editor of Campaign 2012, 12 Independent Ideas for Improving American Public Policy, Law and the Long War, The Future of Justice in the Age of Terror, and editor of Legislating the War on Terror, An Agenda for Reform. He's also been an essential voice, as some of you already know, in the Snowden controversy, testifying before the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence shortly after the Snowden disclosures. Shane Harris is a senior correspondent at the Daily Beast and author of the recently published book, At War, the Rise of the Military Internet Complex. This critically necessary book explores the national security policy and surveillance implications of modern cyber warfare threats. His book received favorable reviews, highly favorable reviews, I might add, in the Washington Post and the LA Times, as well as elsewhere. His first book, The Watchers, chronicling the rise of a national surveillance state, also received rave reviews and was selected the New York Public Library's Helen Bernstein Book Award winner for excellence in journalism and was named one of the best books of 2010 by The Economist. His article, The Social Laboratory, published in Foreign Policy in July 2014, addresses, for those of us who have been wondering, you know, what would the laboratory be if we took cybersecurity and ran with it? Well, there is a laboratory, apparently, and it's called Singapore. And the thing that I found especially fascinating about the article was that Singaporeans took an idea from us and ran with it. So I recommend that article to you as well. Our format tonight will be to have Ben go first, make some remarks.
Give me a second.
He's going second.
Yeah, I demanded it.
Oh, okay. Sorry, I should have done an update before I stood up here. Right, okay. So Shane's going to go first, make some remarks. Ben's going to respond, and then we'll see where it goes from there. I know that we're advertised to finish at 7, but if we'll play it by ear. If everyone is not too exhausted and still engaged, we can carry on a bit. If you have to be somewhere or you're about to, you know, fall into your dessert or something, you may quietly excuse yourself, but we'll go on as long as there's a will. Okay, so please join me in welcoming Shane Harris.
This is why I want to go first in case any of you are sneaking out, because Ben's not going to have anything remotely interesting or provocative to say. Now, Ben and I have known each other a long time, and we agree on most things. We even have a podcast together every week, but I'm not going to let that stop me tonight. So as I give some remarks before my friend and noted NSA apologist Ben Wittes comes in.
Wired magazine.
As the professor said in his opening remarks, I've been sort of writing about the terrain of surveillance and cybersecurity, both in this country and overseas to some extent for a long time. In 2010, I had this book, The Watchers, which the subtitle of it is The Rise of America's Surveillance State, which sounds like a very prescient kind of thing to be, you know, articulating in 2010. But at the time that the book came out, it was very strange. We thought this was sort of a story that people would have heard by now, and it was sort of a history of how we got to this point where we're living in an age of ubiquitous digital surveillance, mostly online. And then you know, 3 years later, this guy Edward Snowden comes along and starts revealing all of these documents. And as Margaret and I were talking earlier tonight, I felt for a long time like a reporter on this beat that I was sort of, you know, feeling at the elephant in the dark. It's like, you know, okay, well, here's the tusk and here's the tail. And you know, based on conversations with sources and some things that would eventually get into the public record, but not too much, sort of trying to paint a picture of what this sort of growing surveillance apparatus looked like. And when Snowden came along, it wasn't so much of a revelation to me as it was more illuminating. It was like the lights in the room kind of got thrown on. And so a lot of us who had been reporting on these issues suddenly could sort of put program names to activities that we knew about and could put dates to things more definitively and had documents that backed it up a lot, which is not by any means to underestimate the gravity of those leaks and what they did for our understanding. But also to say that there was sort of, I think, a bit of a growing awareness of this reality and what I'll talk about in my remarks, I think, you know, the threat that it does pose to civil liberties and privacy before Snowden came along. So they wanted us to sort of do a point-counterpoint here tonight and also kind of reflect on what we heard during the day. So there were a couple big themes that resonated with me based on the work that I've done over the years, that I guess I would boil down largely to the questions of transparency and oversight of this vast system and the questions of privacy, sort of, you know, the bold-faced word there. so let me kind of break those into two categories and start by talking about transparency issues. I missed the first two panels last night, but I came in to hear Mike Hayden give his remarks, and he actually is one of the watchers in The Watchers, so check him out there. I'm not sure how he feels about that, so it's probably a good thing he's not here tonight. Hayden said last night that on the question of Section 215 and the so-called metadata program that Edward Snowden revealed, which I should also note pieces of that were even revealed by USA Today, your former publication, and elsewhere, National Journal, where I used to work. But who's counting? That the government could have been more transparent about what it was doing and why it needed all of this information. I think the phrase that he used was that the government, in hindsight, could have shown a little more leg about what the NSA was up to. Well, that's a very easy thing to say in hindsight, particularly when you are no longer a senior official in the United States intelligence community. But I sincerely doubt that in the future, when the next NSA director or the next DNI has the option to reveal unprompted by a leak some significant level of detail about a domestic intelligence gathering program, that he or she will actually do it. I think the chances of that are basically zero. There's no precedent that I can think of for the intelligence community proactively disclosing significant amounts like this of information about classified operations. In fact, the flood of legal documents and FISA court material that's come out in the wave of the Snowden leaks was, of course, prompted by the Snowden leaks. And it's my understanding that there is disagreement even within the intelligence community and the Obama administration about whether putting all of this formerly top-secret classified material out for public inspection was actually the right thing to do, or whether potentially they even went too far and showed maybe a little too much leg. So one of my favorite stories about how the government seems to regard transparency these days actually comes from President Obama, who, of course, campaigned on a pledge of government transparency, particularly in national security areas where he was formerly against the widespread use of surveillance authorities to collect information on Americans before he voted for it, when it became clear he was going to be president. He first publicly reacted to the controversy over the NSA's surveillance in the wake of the Snowden leaks in a meaningful way in a press conference that he gave in August during the summer months when everyone was on vacation. This is about 2 months after the leaks had actually started. And the way that he tried to describe sort of his fundamental approach to has this system gone too far and has it gone out of hand was he related a story, which was entirely impossible to believe, about how if he told his wife — he said this in a press conference — if I told Michelle after dinner, don't worry, I've washed the dishes, we can go upstairs, everything is taken care of, you know, she probably wouldn't believe me that I'd actually wash the dishes. Never mind that he doesn't wash dishes, that's why she probably wouldn't believe him. But he said, you know, I had to take her back in the kitchen and I had to show her that I washed the dishes. Well, through this sort of, you know, bizarre attenuated metaphor, what he was trying to say to the American public was, don't worry, I'm in the kitchen with NSA and they're keeping the dishes clean, and you can trust me about this. And I wrote this at the time for Foreign Policy when I was working there, that Obama's big fix to the NSA controversy was to make you more comfortable with widespread pervasive surveillance. Don't worry, I'm in the kitchen, I'm watching. So if we're looking to the executive branch to shine a light on itself in this regard, I'd say forget about it. So what about congressional oversight? Here, too, I think, and this came up a lot today in one of our panels, I think the deck is totally stacked here against transparency of these kinds of operations. Bart Forsyth, where are you, Bart? You're over there. I'm going to pick on you. No. aren't you glad you came? You could have left. Yeah. So Bart said something that there was nothing about, and correct me if I'm mischaracterizing you, about nothing about the 215 program essentially that he has seen with his top secret clearance that isn't basically already in the public domain or in the press. And I found this astonishing, and I asked you about this in the Q&A because you are one of the people who is helping to write the law to amend these programs and to bring them more on what we think would be a reasonable footing. Now, I've written a fair amount about the history of congressional oversight, and I'm really, I mean, don't brace yourselves for this. There's actually some exciting stories to tell. And I think I could charitably describe it as pretty anemic, with no offense. this is before you were born, so don't worry. So in 1973, which I guess you would sort of round about the time of the dawn of the modern intelligence oversight process after the wake of the Church Pike Committee hearings, when we actually set up the intelligence committees in the Congress to guard against the abuses of the 1960s when we were spying on Martin Luther King and peace activists and, you know, all the litany of things that I don't think I have to go into now because you know them. Senator John Stennis, who was the chairman of the Armed Services Committee, heard that the CIA director at the time, James Schlesinger, wanted to brief him on an upcoming operation, and Senator Stennis replied, quote, just go ahead and do it, but I don't want to know. That kind of set the tone in some of the early days for what oversight was like of these secret operations. And I think that many in the CIA actually took the senator's advice to heart. Another telling anecdote I like, in 1984, then CIA Director Bill Casey, this is obviously in the Reagan administration, brought to the Congress's attention the fact that the CIA was mining harbors in Nicaragua, but he did so in a massive, many hundreds page report to Congress in which that essential piece of information was effectively buried in the back of the document. Now, still, lawmakers raised no objections about this until 6 weeks later when this news appeared in the press. And angry senators hauled Bill Casey back before their committee and interrogated him over what the CIA was up to in Latin America. They questioned whether the CIA's mining of the harbors was actually an act of war under international law. So not to be outdone in the outrage department here that went back and forth between Congress and the CIA, but a man named Jake Garn, a Republican from Utah and a very staunch defender of the agency, was so incensed that his colleagues would essentially wash their hands of a mission in which he thought they clearly had implicitly condoned, because after all, no one said anything, whether they bothered to read the 800-page report, I'm not sure, that he leapt to Bill Casey's defense and declared on the floor of the House in one of my favorite quotes from an American legislature, quote, "You're all assholes." The whole Congress is full of assholes. All 535 members are assholes. End quote. It's not quite beating somebody with a cane, but it's pretty good. So now, not to put Mr. Forsyth's boss, Mr. Sensenbrenner, in this camp, but I think there's a fairly good historical case that we should not necessarily be dependent on Congress for oversight. But I think there's an even better case and a more an urgent one to make, that Congress has an opportunity to raise an absolute stink about the lack of oversight that it's getting and the level of obfuscation by the executive branch historically, and not just in the context of things like the 215 program, which we talked a lot about today, and what was Congress's real knowledge of what it was that they were actually voting on. And to be fair, I want to say I know from talking to former administration officials who were there at the time that they feel that they gave Congress extraordinary access to information about this program and made information available to them that they would never make available to ordinary members of Congress outside the intelligence committees, and that many members didn't avail themselves of this opportunity. But pretty pessimistic, in my opinion, I am on either the legislative or the executive branch to do a whole lot about transparency of surveillance and the programs and operations and specific we've been talking about today. And I frankly think that leaves people in my job and profession to do a lot of that work. And I thought it was quite notable that the person that Mr. Forsyth credited with giving him the information he needed to oversee our government's surveillance apparatus was Edward Snowden. So I'll leave discussion about the Fourth Estate till the Q&A. Ben is a defrocked journalist, many of you may not know. So you should take that into account.
we call them recovering.
Recovering. He prefers
that's what Shane used to say, and I would always correct him and say defrocked. So he actually is allowed to say that.
I'm just using your words. It's what reporters do. So let me talk a little bit about this other kind of big terrain that we were traversing today of privacy. A few thoughts on that. I think the question of whether you have... let me back up. I think our vocabulary, actually, around privacy, and I'm going to credit Ben with sort of shaping a lot of my thinking, actually, on this over the years, is fundamentally just outdated and outmoded. I thought that before I came to the conference today, and honestly, like a lot of the time that we've spent together has actually reinforced my belief in this. So here's a few thoughts on that. Now, the question came up of whether, for instance, you have a reasonable expectation of privacy from, let's say, a drone when walking down the street. And that seems to me to be fundamentally maybe the wrong question here, because there hasn't really been a time when persistent surveillance, and we got at this, but when persistent surveillance was a reality, and I'm talking about cheap, easy, ubiquitous surveillance of everything that you're doing, whether it's out in public or, frankly, whether it's online. There hasn't been a time when it's been technologically and legally trivial to put together a mosaic of someone's life based on an array of data points held in different places. I wrote a lot about this in my first book and to some extent in the second about the potential danger for a system like this particularly when it's controlled by government. And I want to note here that I'm saying potential danger. I don't argue in the book that we have replicated the Stasi. But I think it's also vitally important that we recognize we've built a system that even the Stasi probably could not have imagined or have created. It doesn't mean we're using it, but I think that the capability is immense and it's real. I would posit, though, and here I'm just going to be provocative, maybe not just to Ben, but maybe to the room, that I'm not sure that people really want to be private, at least not in the way that we've historically thought of it since those days when John Schlesinger was being told, you know, go ahead and do what you want. Or put another way, that we maybe want to choose who to be private from. One of the things I've observed over the years of reporting on this topic is that we get very worked up about government surveillance more so than private surveillance. And I think there's good reasons for that. The history of abuses, of course, in the intelligence community, and the fact that the government has the guns and they can lock you up. And it seems to me that's a pretty reasonable thing to be worried about. But I like this notion of what Mr. Hartzog was talking about obscurity. And to kind of play on that, I think that people want to remain obscure to the government more so than to their friends on Facebook, or maybe lots of people on Facebook. But I think we're entering into an era where people want to sort of adjust and fine-tune and customize what it is that privacy means to them. And I just don't think that that's something that the law can really grapple with right now. But here's the other thing that's really interesting about this. The group that really understands, I think, what I was just saying about how we sort of customize privacy and understands how the rules of it have changed and the mores around it, is the intelligence community. So let me relate one of the more illuminating points on this that I've actually found from my research. This is a quote from a man named Donald Kerr, who at the time that he said it was the principal deputy director of national intelligence, so the number two intelligence official in the entire intelligence community. He said, quote, "Too often, privacy has been equated with anonymity, and it's an idea that is deeply rooted in American culture. But in our interconnected and wireless world, anonymity, or the appearance of anonymity, is quickly becoming a thing of the past." And he went on to say, "I think people here," he was speaking at a conference, of people mostly his peers, by the way, "I think people here, at least the people close to my age, recognize that these two generations younger than us have a very different idea of what essential privacy is, what they would wish to protect about their lives and affairs, and so it's not for us to inflict a one-size-fits-all." This is the second highest-ranking intelligence official in the U.S. government. And it's worth noting that he said this in 2007, which doesn't seem that long ago, but it was only 3.5 years after Facebook had launched. It was just 1 year after Twitter's founding. In 2007, by the way, he gave this speech. Twitter was posting about 400,000 tweets per quarter. That went up to 100 million tweets per quarter in 2008. And by February 2010, Twitter users were posting 50 million tweets per day. And it's worth noting that he was giving this speech 3 years before we had Instagram. So it doesn't seem that long ago, but I think these remarks were incredibly prescient. And I think he's been borne out. So the intelligence community knows that the world has changed. They've adapted much better than those, I think, who would like to rein them in. And so I think this leaves us needing to have an entirely new set of conversations about privacy and transparency and what those two concepts actually mean and how we can realistically achieve them. Ben, over to you.
So now you're going to find out why I'm really speaking second. I noticed, Shane and I noticed that Margaret had called this event Point Counterpoint, which some of you may be old enough to remember was the name of a Saturday Night Live sketch many years ago. So let me just start by saying, Shane, you ignorant slut. All right. I certainly hope so. So Margaret, I think, asked me here because of a speech I gave in Germany that she was present for. I was asked to come to Freiburg and talk about NSA. The NSA mysteriously didn't want to send somebody to Freiburg to talk about their surveillance policies. The Germans find that surprising, actually. I was a little less surprised. And So they invited me instead. You know, my older child right now is going through a process of a legal name change. And so I was in Superior Court in Washington with him to initiate this name change. And I was thinking to myself, maybe I should change my name to noted NSA apologist Benjamin Littles. The paperwork was right there. I almost picked it up. I started my remarks in Freiburg, and this Margaret still talks about it, and I'm going to disappoint her by not sort of going through the whole thing. But I started my remarks by saying to this group of very earnest German academics, and there's nobody as earnest like an earnest German academic. I said to them,
I mean, you
can end up talking about Kant very quickly and almost by accident. And I started by saying to them, you know, I've never traveled so far to such a beautiful place to offend so many nice-looking people. And there's that scene in Annie Hall where Woody Allen sees himself at Annie Hall's dinner table at home in Iowa or wherever she's from, the way he thinks her family sees him, and all of a sudden he has side locks and he's dressed like a Hasidic Jew. And I had this moment where I see myself the way they see me, and I have a giant cowboy hat and big boots. And so I just kind of ran with it, and I said, so look, but I'm here to tell you, grow up. And so I was going to tell this whole story, except that General Hayden apparently had the exact same experience in Germany and told the story last night. The story's basically the same, so I'm going to disappoint Margaret and stop there. I'm going to talk about something else instead. I was listening to all the panels today, and I have a few thoughts about law, privacy, national security, and culture in roughly that order. And I'm going to try to be very brief about it. So here's what I'm going to say. Number one, in thinking about what is going to condition our privacy, I want to suggest that there are a few things that are really overrated. And they are roughly everything we talked about today. That is to say, national security, the Fourth Amendment, and law. And there's one huge thing that is grossly underrated, and that's culture. And so I want to sketch that out a little bit, and then I'm going to shut up and open things up. So first really big overrated thing, national security. Yes, there were the Snowden revelations. Some of us really basked in them. They always said about about George, the Bush presidency, you know, it was bad for the country but good for the nation. Well, the Snowden revelations may be bad for the country. They were really good for me, you know. Yes, exactly. It's how I acquired my new name. That said, I think the idea that our privacy as individuals, for most, I would venture to say all people in this room, is meaningfully conditioned by national security relative to the other variables that condition your privacy is laughable. Okay? So I know a lot of people who've had privacy problems over the years. I know very few who have privacy problems as a result of national security. Now, some of that is, of course, a reflection of the people that I know. But some of it is also a reflection of the fact that in the world of things that meaningfully affect your privacy, national security actually rates very low on that list. What rates really high on that list? The companies you deal with. How much your friends are assholes. That's the big one, by the way. I mean, you know, if your friends are jerks, you have big privacy problems. If your friends are good people, you're going to have less privacy problems. We never talk about that as sort of a major threat to privacy, but it really is. Other people suck. Other things that really meaningfully condition your privacy. Mistakes. You lost your wallet. It had a password in it. That's a real privacy problem. So there's one of my merchants is corrupt, and twice in the last 2 weeks has stolen my credit card number, manufactured a credit card, and gone on a shopping spree. My credit card company, this is a real privacy problem, actually. It has nothing to do with national security. It has everything to do with money, right? So if you make a list of the things that actually threaten your privacy, it is a relatively small number of people that national security is really on that list. Now, I want to add one thing to that. Most of those people don't even know it. We know that all of our metadata is in a metadata database. And that's this kind of hypothetical, theoretical privacy violation. Query how much it really affects your life. Okay, so national security is overrated. Second thing that's overrated, whatever the solution's going to be, sorry, Crystal Bogan, it's not going to be the Fourth Amendment. The Fourth Amendment, we love debating the Fourth Amendment because the Fourth Amendment is, you know, the Constitution. There's got this great original understanding history. It's got 200 years of case law. It's really interesting. It's a great set of lawyers' puzzles. And at the end of the day, in very limited areas of your life, is your privacy actually conditioned by the Fourth Amendment? There are areas, but if you were going to scatter map, like, what are the things that affect your privacy, it's not the big one, all right? Next one, all this stuff about privacy law. It's totally overrated. We have privacy law. We talk about privacy, what the law should be. The law actually doesn't change on privacy very much. You know, the privacy laws we're dealing with, they're pretty static. Most of it develops in case law. Most of it develops in practice. We have much more discussion about what the law should be than we have actual legal change, and yet privacy norms change, and they change substantially. So there's something else driving it. Now, I want to suggest that there's really one big force that is just dramatically under-discussed and really important, and there's an important subtext to it. And the underrated force is culture. And the subtext is that culture is defined by a pre-legal set of common law developments between users and the companies that serve them. We tend to belittle this with references to things like terms of service that you click through without thinking about. And yes, that's right. It's a ridiculous way to make rules. It's a ridiculous way to make norms. It is, in fact, the way we make rules and norms. Now, some of this gets enforced through the FTC as a functional matter. Some of it, they get pushed by a lot of things. But these are, I think, the great drivers is what consumers tolerate from companies. Companies will get away with what they can. What companies have to do because their customers get pissed off. What companies want to do because there's a competitive advantage in being the most consumer-friendly and the most privacy-friendly company. There was a point at which, and you could really see this, particularly if you talk to the companies and spent time with the way they presented themselves. There was a point about, I don't know, 7 years ago or so, where Google decided we're going to be the good guys in privacy, and Facebook decided we're going to be the line-pushing, you know, forward-leaning, not-so-good guys. And Google got rewarded, and Facebook got punished, and Facebook, you know, came back. These tactical decisions vis-a-vis people's consumers had way more impact on people's day-to-day policy than the entire post-Snowden discussion and all the legal reforms anybody has discussed, you know, over the last 2 years. So I want to make a little bit of a conceptual argument about why culture matters so much more than law in this. Number one, Because we say privacy, we all use the same word, and we all mean totally different things by it. Now, this is really true when you talk in Germany. So when I'm talking to Germans, the Germans are very upset at us about the Snowden revelations. In Germany, when you move, you have to report your new address to the local police department. The police department's entitled to know where everybody lives. Now, if you could have did that in the United States, there would be riots in the street, right? It's an unthinkable thing to do to Americans, to report your location to the police so they can demand your papers, right? It's unthinkable. In Germany, when you say this, what, you know, there are people who you have to report where you live, they say, yeah, well, what's the problem? Right? That's not in their conception of privacy. United States, we had, after Newtown, there was an incident in which a local newspaper, I forget whether it was in New York or Connecticut, I think it was on the New York side of the line, went and got all the gun registrations under public record law in New York and did a Google map so you could look up, enter your address, and they'd show you everybody in your neighborhood who was packing. And there was an outraged response to this from gun owners who considered it a violation of privacy. And now, I would venture to guess that in Germany, that idea that you had a not merely a right to own an assault weapon, but a right to privacy in the ownership of an assault weapon would have been as peculiar as the idea in America that you should be able to, you know, that you should have to report your location to the police. Take an example from two legal systems that are a little closer together. Somebody who knows both who knows British and American surveillance law better than I do, correct me if I get the details of this wrong. But, you know, American and British law are about as close as, you know, we're Anglo-American jurisprudence, right? In the United States, of course, it's pretty hard to get a search warrant or a wiretap order. You need probable cause of a crime. You need to go before an independent judge. But once you get that wiretap order, the fruits of it are admissible in a criminal proceeding. In Britain, if you want a wiretap order, you can get it on the order of the Home Office. You don't have to go before a judge. There's a very low evidentiary showing. But the fruits of that wiretap are never admissible in court in British law. These are both privacy protections. They protect entirely different things, right? They're both wiretap rules. So number one, across culture, don't think that people mean the same thing when they say privacy. Secondly, and this is a harder point, and I'm going to close with it. When we keep score domestically about privacy, we only count one side of the ledger. And this is particularly true of new technologies. So we have all these technologies that are, you know, we think of them as having privacy costs. And we think of the benefits of them as being convenience. So, you know, take Google for Google's a great example, right? You have the benefit, the convenience benefit that you can look up anything anytime. You can search things. But the cost is it gets logged, and Google has a record of that, and that can be recovered by law enforcement or by anybody else under certain circumstances, right? We never count the privacy benefits of these technologies. We write them out of the equation. Now, what are the privacy benefits, say, of Google search? So the other day, I decided to figure out how I could test that. And I figured that Google auto-suggests searches, you know, if you start typing things. It'll try to finish it for you. So I typed, "I am afraid that." Now, it suggested I might be afraid I was pregnant. I might be afraid that I was gay. I might be afraid that my girlfriend is gay or that my boyfriend is gay. It suggested to me a whole bunch of things, highly sensitive things about my life, that suggest to me that a huge number of people are getting enormous privacy benefit from being able, in the privacy of their own homes, to find out intimate information about themselves that they care about. I did a whole lot of these searches. I'm going to publish some of the results of them relatively soon. Let me give you another example. This one's somewhat comical, but I think it's illustrative. When privacy advocates talk about terrible privacy technologies, one of the technologies that people often come up with is the Amazon Kindle. And the Amazon Kindle, from a privacy point of view, is a really ugly thing, right? Because it used to be you buy a book, and maybe you pay cash for it, and nobody has the book. Nobody knows you have the book. But now you have a Kindle, you order it. Not only is there a record that you have the book, but Amazon knows what page of the book you're on, right? And so this is really, and all of this is recoverable data. Guess what? Sales of 50 Shades of Grey are much higher on Amazon Kindle than they are in person. And the reason is that the privacy that people care about, turns out we don't mind that much if Amazon knows what 50 pages of what page of 50 Shades of Grey we're on, but we really care if the person next to us on the metro knows we're reading the book. And so even within the context of a culture that thinks it knows what privacy is, the privacy gains and losses that individuals are experiencing from technologies that actually have very complicated cultural interactions with privacy are complicated, and they're nuanced, and they're highly individualized. And so what I'm going to suggest, and I'm going to stop right here, that it is the aggregated preferences of very large numbers of individuals in interactions with companies over time that is the principal determinant of our privacy, and we really ought to be looking more than we are and at broad-scale behavioral patterns if we want to learn both as a normative matter, as a functional matter, where we're going, as a descriptive matter, but also, I think, as a normative matter, just stop with the 50 Shades of Grey example. If large numbers of people actually feel that the privacy of their immediate environment is more important than the privacy of some server collecting data somewhere far away, that's something that privacy activists don't care very much about. And I'm saying maybe they should.
After those two presentations, I can't imagine that anyone would have any questions or challenges. So we're done, right? Yeah, let's... No? Oh, okay. Yes, sir.
So first thing, Ben, just don't tell my dean. Irrelevant, because then I'm in big trouble.
I didn't say irrelevant. I said overrated.
Overrated, okay. Well, don't tell him that either. So, I like your point about culture. I think there's a lot to it. But, I mean, of course, the Fourth Amendment can influence culture.
Of course.
So to take in your comparative point, in Germany and France, usually you don't need a warrant to go into a home. You do in the United States because of the Fourth Amendment. In France, you can stop someone for 4 hours if they don't have an ID. You can't do that in this country because of the Fourth Amendment. There's no exclusionary rule in either of those two countries. So our perception of privacy and how it's protected is pretty heavily influenced. I mean, I agree with your general point, but I think it's important to factor back in the Fourth Amendment through the cultural prism.
Right. So let me be clear. I agree with that completely. One of the very important determinants and influences of culture is law, and vice versa. And I was being intentionally provocative when I and partly reflecting the. Partly reflecting the fact that in a conference of lawyers and law professors, the doctrinal side, both current and past and future, always gets disproportionate discussion. And so I was being a little bit flip in joshing that. And yes, I do think that there is a very deep cultural relationship between the Fourth Amendment and privacy values. I do think one of the things about talking about the Fourth Amendment as obsessively as we do is that we don't First of all, it greatly conditions a discussion based on the relationship between individuals and government, whereas I actually think a large part of our privacy in practice is now being determined by a different set of relationships, which isn't to say those are unimportant. I just think you risk overstating the importance of government in conditioning privacy by focusing on the Fourth Amendment to the exclusion of other things. But yes, I agree with your point completely.
No, I would just say, I mean, one point I would push back about from what Ben said earlier is, you know, he made the point that you're not going to solve the issue necessarily through the Fourth, or that the Fourth Amendment is not the avenue through which we're going to address many of these big problems. And I disagree. I mean, I think that the court has indicated that it is eager to take up the issues presented in Smith v. Maryland, which bear directly not just on the 215 program, but presumably on the use of metadata all across the intelligence community in the national security space. And we should remember, too, that, I mean, not necessarily in every instance, but it is the use of, it is metadata, ultimately, and I think this is a place where you and I agree fundamentally, that is much more vital to the intelligence community and is much less governed in a sort of more of a kind of a Wild West space, I think. Most of our laws are really around what the government can do with the content of communications, not so much the metadata. And it seems to me that that's fundamentally a Fourth Amendment issue. So if we're talking about restricting the government's use of our personal information in a meaningful way in a big space, that yes, you will get to that through the Fourth Amendment. Right, and the question of whether it applies to metadata.
Professor Weaver.
Chris, I don't disagree with your characterization of French law, and I don't disagree with your characterization of the burden of requirement that the report there has to produce. But I got to say, when I look at Germany, they tend to be much more protective of privacy in many important steps, especially against, you know, we always look at people versus the government. And when I see the Germans, they seem to be much more concerned about, and the French in many respects, much more concerned about what private companies are doing. So they're pushing, you know, you have the data protection laws, a lot of things like that. And actually, it's even a bit of a culture clash because the Swedes, for example, have been very transparent, looking very strongly in the open government. And they're actually upset by the European data protection. This may require us to protect stuff that we think should be on the open. So, in general, I agree with everything you said, but that one area, I think the Germans are more protective.
Right. So, you're absolutely right that there is a fixation with data protection, which Europeans call data protection and we call privacy. In the European Union. And they have, you know, this is an area where I think there is just a dramatic culture clash. And I respect where the Germans are coming from. If I had lived in a country that had the recent experience of both the Gestapo and the Stasi, I might have a very different attitude than toward intelligence agencies than I do having grown up in a country where, A, we had abuses, and B, we got them under control, right? We have a very different experience of the value and risk of intelligence agencies, domestic intelligence agencies, than the Germans do. Moreover, let's be honest, the Germans have paid a huge price for their attitudes toward this stuff. Silicon Valley is not in anywhere near Frankfurt, and you know there is a giant industry, whole industry sector of the economy that has left Europe behind, and so they have lived their values on this, and they pay many percentage points in GDP every year for it. That said, in some ways, the difference is greater apparently than in reality, because what the European Union has is very strong rules and very weak enforcement. And what the United States has is relatively weak rules and, you know, very strong enforcement. And so if you look at functionally what you can get away with in the European Union and what you can get away with in the United States, it's not that different. You know, Google and Facebook look more or less the same in Europe, except, you know, there's some right to be forgotten. But it's basically the same set of services. So I think you're right, there is a deep culture clash, and it reflects a different view of what privacy is and what it demands of us. I also think the quality of that clash is sometimes a little bit less than it seems to be.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. And as always, please spread the word and promote the Lawfare podcast via your social networks on Twitter, Facebook, email, or in any other way you can. Thanks for listening.